Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-30518, State versus Metcalf. Arguing for the petitioner, Summer Kapow. Arguing for the respondent, Ricky Damerville. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed with your arguments today? Okay, my understanding, Ms. Kapow, you want you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a light comes on with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Damerville, you wanted a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument, so we'll do that for you. Ms. Kapow, please proceed.
May it please the court. Deputy Public Defender Summer Kapow, on behalf of petitioner appellant Kevin Metcalf. Kevin Metcalf is currently sitting in prison. He's a 50-year-old commercial fisherman, Christmas tree farmer, again, currently serving a 20-year sentence for defending himself and his property from a burglary in progress at his own home. The erroneous convictions in this case were obtained where experts were allowed to testify in fields in which they did not possess expertise, where the jury was not properly instructed on how to treat the expert testimony, nor on the all applicable defenses, and where trial counsel rendered ineffective assistance. And all of this where initially a grand jury returned a no bill. Based on the myriad of errors present on this record, Mr. Metcalf is entitled to a new trial. We raised 6 points in our application for writ of certiorari, but I plan to focus on 3 of the errors that I believe are the most egregious. And I would begin with the inadmissible expert testimonies first. Second, the omission of the jury instruction on defense of property, second. And finally, the erroneous self-defense instruction. The purported trend in the Third Circuit is to not tender witnesses as experts and to refrain from using the term expert, and this trend must be stopped. First, it violates the evidence rules, Rules 701 and 702. Second, it keeps the jury from appropriately assessing expert testimony in the manner prescribed by the rules. In this case, the state never offered, the trial court never accepted, both Dr. Manoukian and Detective Amo as expert witnesses. The fields of their expertise were never identified. Now, the errors are crucial here, where these witnesses may have been experts in some field. I mean, they were experts, it was clear, in a certain field, but the substance of their testimonies, the opinions they rendered, the way in which the state utilized their testimonies in order to obtain a conviction, all of that testimony was in a field in which Dr. Manoukian and Detective Amo did not possess expert qualifications. Looking first at Dr. Manoukian's testimony, the substance of his testimony was that he rendered an opinion that the decedent died to a shotgun wound to the back. That was one thing, shotgun wound to the back. And he also rendered an opinion on distance, that he was shot from a distance of 60 feet, which he referred to as a ballpark figure, using quote unquote a general rule of thumb. He also opined that there was no evidence that the decedent was moving, either turning left to right. And he also opined that there was nothing to indicate close range firing. And he said that he rendered that opinion based on the lack of quote unquote a wad injury, large central defect, or gunpowder or heat injury.
Ms. Kapow, this testimony was not objected to at trial, is that correct?
That is correct.
How does it figure in plain error analysis?
In plain error analysis, looking at whether it affected substantial rights, we're arguing that it affected his right to a fair trial, that it contributed to his conviction, and that the error was not harmless because, again, the way the state utilized the testimony. It was clear from the beginning that the state's theory was, well, it was clear that this was going to be a difficult case for them. I remind the court that it was first a no bill, then they went the route of preliminary hearing. Two critical things that they knew they had to overcome, two weaknesses in their case. First, the 911 call. 30 minutes of Mr. Metcalf calling for help. It was clear in the 911 call where he says that his knees are knocking, that...
Will you address the plain error analysis instead of what was the factual basis?
Oh, I'm sorry. The substantial rights, that this evidence, which should not have been admissible. Again, defense counsel didn't object. Defense counsel should have asked, first of all, asked to voir dire, not just cross-examine the witness after the testimony, but to voir dire the witness, because it was clear that both witnesses did not have expert qualifications in the field of forensic ballistic analysis.
So you're talking about now ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well,
you're
both.
Talking about what he didn't do.
Why not? Why is it plain error? Because it affected a substantial right, and it's the way that the state utilized the testimony.
Has this court repeatedly held that failures to object to evidence, there are a lot of different kinds of things that you can fail to object to,
you know,
whether prejudicial testimony, prosecutorial misconduct, there's all kinds of things that one might have an objection to and not make. But with regard to the admissibility of evidence, hasn't this court very consistently held that that's not, does not affect a substantial right, that it's not subject to plain error? State versus Wallace, where we looked at the question about the admissibility of issues related to testing of drugs and weighing of drugs, a number of other cases where we've looked at straight evidentiary issues and have not found it to be affect the substantial rights of the defendant. So are you arguing, would you agree with that? And if so, are you arguing for an extension of our law? And why should we recognize that extension?
I'm not sure if it would be an extension. And again, I'm familiar with Wallace, but I'm not sure about whether or the standard that we're talking about that should apply here. But the standard that I think we argued in the briefs is that the error was not harmless in looking at, yes, it's an evidentiary matter, but also a constitutional right to a fair trial, to have the state be held to the burden of proof.
Have we ever gone that far and said, where there's just a failure to object to evidence with not another separate right implicated because of that failure, and said that that is enough to trigger a plain error to find that there's been an effect on a substantial right of the defendant? Have we ever gone that far in a case where it's just an objection evidence to the admissibility of evidence?
I off the top of my head, just thinking of cases, I can't say that the court has. I think, but always where we have prevailed on plain error and evidence, I think it has been tied to a constitutional right. But I cannot come up with a case where, yes, where purely it's just the inadmissibility of evidence that was the error, or the court's failure to keep the evidence out, where that alone entitled a person to a new trial. I can't think of a case. But here, again, it is tied to a constitutional right. And the way the state utilized the testimonies of these witnesses, again, the weaknesses in the state's case from the beginning was that 911 call. It was clear from there if the court listens.
Substantial rights don't necessarily have to be limited to constitutional rights, right?
It does.
Assuming there are constitutional rights, because I thought we held that in terms of statutory rights, you could, like peremptory challenges, for example. If you violate that, then you can raise plain error, I guess. I don't know. But substantial rights in and of itself doesn't limit the objection to constitutional.
Yes, I didn't mean to say that. It is not limited to just constitutional rights. Yes. And again, going back to these quote unquote expert testimonies, looking at now Detective Amo, or again going back to the fact that the state had a weakness in their case. They knew that they had to overcome the 911 call where there was clearly a defense, self-defense, defense of property at issue. Second, where the evidence,
counsel,
yes.
What was lacking in the foundation for qualifications of the expert Manoukian?
Well, with looking at Dr. Manoukian, he is qualified. He's a forensic pathologist, has testified numerous times in Hawaii cases, and there was a string of cases cited by the state in their briefs. So we don't challenge the fact that he is qualified to render opinions on, say, causes of death. He's limited to, though, pathology, meaning he studies the body, the way tissues, body fluids, and to determine causes of injury, causes of death. But in this case, he went beyond just determining the cause of death and the type, looking at the injury. He further opined, again, beyond his expertise, he opined that the decedent had been shot from a distance of 60 feet.
Well, didn't he also testify that in the textbooks of forensic pathology, for a shotgun using birdshot, there's a general rule of thumb that the diameter of the pellet injury times 3 equals, in a ballpark figure, the distance in feet between the decedent and the barrel of the shotgun. And he said, based on the 21 and a half inches, that gives you approximately 60 feet.
That is correct. He did testify to that, but
so it appears that this type of knowledge appears in textbooks of pathology, correct?
Yes, based on that one statement that he gave. But still, it was not enough to qualify him. But
didn't
to
he say he had received specialized training in ballistics at the Maryland State Crime Lab?
He said that he attended classes, but he was also very clear that he was not a ballistics expert. He admitted, I'm not a firearms or ballistics expert, and this is in the in his testimony of February 3rd at page 52.
But doesn't his testimony actually go to weight rather than qualifications?
No, it goes to qualifications. It goes to admissibility. Again, the problem in this case, and again, this so-called trend in the Third Circuit, is they're not offering, the state is not offering, and even defense, I'm sure even defendants, but it sounds like there's an unspoken policy among the attorneys that we're not going to call these guys experts. We're not going to properly offer them up in accordance with 701, in accordance with 702,
what,
and have
does 701 require a proffer of an expert and the judge to say in front of the jury that this person is qualified as an expert in a certain area?
It does not explicitly state that, but
I know that was the past practice.
Yes.
However, is it possible that 1102 might actually prohibit that past practice?
I'm sorry, with
Hawaii Rules of Evidence Rule 1102, which says that the court shall instruct the jury, but shall not comment upon the evidence?
I don't think it's a commenting on the evidence because, again, this goes into our other issue with the opinion instruction. If the fear is that we're going to be, if the fear is that the jury might place these experts on a pedestal because we use the term expert, the expert opinion instruction in the Hodget is there to neutralize that impact and to make clear that yes, certain witnesses were admitted to offer expert opinions in an area in the field, a certain field of expertise. But you, the jury, even though you're bound to find them that they're qualified in this area, you can assess whatever weight you feel appropriate. And that was the problem in this case. Because
but isn't that up to the attorneys to then lay the proper foundation and to object if they think that expert testimony is being rendered in an area that the expert has not been, in which the witness has not been properly qualified as an expert?
Yes, it is. I agree. It's up to the attorneys. But in this case, because we know that the state never offered this witness up, because the judge is the gatekeeper, essentially, of the evidence. The judge is the person that instructs, has the duty to instruct the jury properly on all the law. In this case, it was an error on the court, not just the attorney. So we are arguing, yes, ineffective assistance, but also in this case, because the opinion instruction, because they doctored it, the way they took out the term expert and put in other language, that misled the jury.
How does it prejudice them for them to refer to it as opinion as opposed to expert? How does it
prejudice
them?
It's not so much that they use someone who is qualified to give an opinion, but again, because there was no formal tendering, because the judge never told the jury that I am going to accept this witness as an expert in the area of, say, forensic pathology, the jury couldn't then properly assess and determine how to give weight to the testimony.
Isn't there an argument to be made that then the judge is then commenting on the evidence and he is saying that this person is an expert in this area?
No, because the judge is telling the jury, and again, this is in the commentary to Rule 702, that yes, the jury is bound. You as a jury are bound to find that this person is qualified in a specific area. Now, if that person is testifying to matters.
Let me ask you first. At least for purposes of rules of evidence, witnesses are divided into two categories, right? Either they're lay witnesses or they're expert witnesses.
Yes.
And who decides who is what?
It's the court.
And in this case, did the court decide that?
The court was silent. And even though attorneys
didn't object. So how was the jury to know whether somebody is a lay witness or somebody is an expert witness?
They're not going to know unless the judge instructs them.
And did the judge instruct them?
Not in this record, no.
How are we to know whether the judge made that decision if it's not on the record?
I'm sorry, and we meaning the
made the distinction saying, okay, this is a lay witness and this is an expert witness. How are we supposed to know the judge made that decision?
There's nothing to show, but I think it's akin
so
to...
So we don't know that.
We don't know.
We don't know whether the court treated these people as lay or as expert witnesses.
We don't know.
Okay. So how is the jury supposed to know?
They didn't, and that was...
If the jury, according to the commentary, is bound by the court's determination of who is an expert witness, and I suppose inferentially who is a lay witness, how can they be bound if they don't know?
They weren't bound, and they, again, were not equipped with...
They didn't know.
They didn't know.
So can they be bound?
No.
If they can't be bound, then how do we know that they did what they were supposed to do?
We don't. And in fact, it shows that they could have one option is that they blanketly accepted every single thing that came out of both of those expert witnesses' mouths.
But weren't they instructed not to do that? Isn't that exactly what the instruction that the court gave, where it modified expert to read opinion, that merely because such an such a witness has expressed an opinion does not mean, however, that you must accept this opinion, is up to you to decide it? So wouldn't that instruction have alerted the jurors to the fact that there are categories of evidence that they're receiving that fall into this category of opinion testimony if it's supported by training and experience?
It does alert them, but again, without the court saying or identifying, telling them what field of practice or field of expertise these witnesses were confined to, I mean, without laying out the parameters for the jury, they couldn't properly
do their
job. Let
me ask you, was the instruction, I don't know if I'm reading it right, you have the instruction in front of you?
I do have the instruction.
Training and experience may make a person qualified to give opinion testimony in a particular field.
Yes.
And so was the jury ever told which person was qualified to give opinion testimony in a particular field?
No, they were not.
So how is the jury to follow this instruction? Because it says, during the trial, you heard the testimony of one or more witnesses who are allowed to give opinion testimony. I suppose everyone there, although I didn't read through the whole transcript, in some sense or other, might have rendered an opinion. Training and experience may make a person qualified to give opinion testimony in a particular field. So how is a jury to know who was qualified to give opinion testimony in a particular field?
They didn't, and we don't know if they...
But wouldn't the key premise be that the opposing counsel has to object? Isn't that the premise of this approach, that opposing counsel needs to object? Absent that objection, the testimony is admitted and then subject to these principles.
Well, again, that aside from the ineffective assistance, yes, of course, defense counsel should have objected, should have said, we have to follow the procedure. You say you need to formally offer these witnesses up for formal tendering as experts in a particular
field. Or could have simply
field.
Said this witness is testifying to an area outside of his or her expertise.
Yes, and that's what's so troubling, because during cross-examination, at least with respect to Detective Amol, I agree that defense counsel actually did a great job in cross-examining the witness, pointing out certain weaknesses in the opinion itself, but still coupled with the testimony of Dr. Manoukian, the prejudice was that it bolstered. Now you have two people who are called these big words, forensic, you know, they're pathologists, forensic pathologists, detectives certified by the NRA, SWAT team member.
But isn't exactly what defense counsel is trying to do is to get defense counsel's theory of the case out through the government's experts. Would you agree with me? That's what happened, certainly with Amo.
With Amo, it appeared to have been that way, yes.
Because he asked Amo, could the shot pattern be affected if the gun was moving at the time?
Yes.
Yes. Got Amo to acknowledge that pellets wouldn't even go through cardboard, even as close as 10 feet. Again, sort of coming back to the notion that this firearm could have been shot much closer,
yes.
Right? And then I think also got him to acknowledge that if two shots were fired in close succession, the pattern could overlap.
And it would change if they're moving, yes.
Okay, so he got out, in essence, his theory of the case – through Mo. He also appeared to try to get it out to Dr. Manoukian, but Dr. Manoukian said, I don't know whether moving the barrel will change the shot pattern. In fact, that's when he said, I'm not an expert in ballistics. Isn't that right?
Yes, but Dr. Manoukian did say, though, there was no evidence of close-range firing.
But isn't that well within his type of expertise? Don't forensic pathologists talk about whether there are wounds on the body and what those kinds of wounds mean? That's wholly apart from the ballistic evidence, isn't it?
Well,
in other words, he said, I'm a forensic pathologist. I examined this body. I didn't see any evidence that the wad hit the body. I mean, are you suggesting that's not something a pathologist can do?
I don't think there was sufficient foundation in this case for this particular pathologist to render that opinion.
About wounds on the body?
He could talk about the wounds in the body, but not opine that there was no evidence of close-range firing. What's actually troubling in this case is, yes, defense counsel may have undertaken that strategy, may have thought, you know what, I'm not going to object to admissibility, I'm going to go on weight based on my skill. And he actually appeared to have done that because he also treated an officer, police officer John Smith, who was an experienced hunter, as an expert, and questioned him about, at some time in his childhood, while he was out hunting, he actually got shot from 60 feet away by the same number birdshot, number 6, and that it didn't even pierce him. But even with all this evidence.
So could the jury consider him a qualified expert in a particular field?
They may have with this instruction without identifying.
He gave opinions, right?
He did give opinions.
Was he qualified as an expert?
He was not qualified as an expert and not.
Well, assuming someone says enough that you can say he's a person qualified to give an opinion testimony. But in what particular field? Was that ever made clear to the jury in what particular field?
It was not made clear to the jury.
Was the term ballistics ever defined?
Not by the attorney. It's just the one time where the doctor admitted, I'm not a ballistics expert. But what I wanted to point out was just look, and I've read through the entire record. I wasn't the trial attorney, but I looked at everything. And what's so troubling is that there were inconsistencies in the record. And this would go to a harmless error analysis. But looking at photographs, the state's exhibits, where it's clear that doctor.
For all we know, then, the jury could have treated the testimony of Officer Smith as the testimony of an expert and adopted his opinions?
They could have, but it's obvious that they did not. The people they treated as experts were these men who, again, came in there talking about qualifications in a field that's not related, using terminology, and they were shrouded in expertise. I mean, that's basically what it is.
But he utilized their expertise to get his theory of the case up, the defense attorney did. He got exactly what he wanted out of Amo, and then he argued that in closing, didn't he? Which is, you heard that shot patterns can be affected if the gun is moving, that pellets don't even go through cardboard at 10 feet, that two shots fired in close proximity could have patterns that crossover. That was exactly his explanation for what happened in this case, right?
Yes, but again, coupled with the fact that almost test firing, which again lacked foundation, coupled with Dr. Manoukian's testimony on the distance, that now the prosecutor could argue that he was shot at least from 40 feet away. That coupled with again the diagram, and this is getting to another point of error, the total station device, the measurements from there. Now they're hearing numbers and this fancy equipment, which the person admitted we borrowed from another place, but it was never calibrated. That coupled with a diagram and all this evidence that's lacking proper foundation, all of that together meant that the jury looked at these people as experts and relied on their testimony, put it on a pedestal, precisely what all the parties, including the court, wanted to avoid.
Well, the prosecution in this case relied heavily on Dr. Manoukian's and Officer Amo's testimony.
Yes.
In its closing argument.
Yes, and in fact, even in opening
statement. To try
statement.
To prove that, I guess, the decedent was running away when he was shot in the back. Therefore, the self-defense defense didn't really work.
Yes.
But, you know, even if the attorneys should have done this, if they did something for strategic reasons, does that have any impact on what the court's obligation was to make sure that the jury understood its role and understood what evidence it could consider and should consider?
No, that duty alone belonged to the court. It was for the court to properly instruct the jury on the law. And that goes hand in hand with our other arguments in our application, including the omission of the defense of property instruction, as well as the erroneous self-defense instruction that misled, it was confusing and misled the jury. In looking at defense of property, you know, in this case, it's true that the defendant himself testified that he wasn't, in the moment that the shotgun went off, he wasn't thinking about his marijuana. And yet, that, you know, that was a theory by the state, that this was a stage, that he, you know, there's talk about in the closing about an elaborate surveillance system. That was the state's theory, that he was ready and waiting to shoot anyone who came onto his property. But that wasn't the case.
But didn't defense counsel actually disavow reliance on defense of property in their closing?
Yes,
we're not relying on that. We're not here to tell you that it's okay to shoot somebody because they're trying to get your plants. We're here to tell you it's okay to shoot somebody if you think they're going to kill you because they have a hacksaw in their hand. That was his theory.
And, of course, it's the defense attorney's prerogative to undertake whatever trial strategy he wanted to at the time. But it was the court's independent duty to equip the jury with all the applicable laws. And in this case, the jury convicted without knowing that there's a law out there that would allow Mr. Metcalf to arm himself with a shotgun.
It was property.
To protect his property, yes. I'm talking specifically to the omitted law, the omitted instruction, that up until the time the shotgun went off, and some would argue that even after the shotgun went off. I mean, looking at this case, big picture perspective, yes, self-defense applied because he was scared that night. That's why he shot, when he thought someone was lunging at him with a hacksaw. But stepping back, even looking from the beginning, why did he need a shotgun? Because of all of the past burglaries. That's the credible evidence. That's the evidence, no matter how weak, that entitled him to not only a self-defense instruction, but to a defense of property instruction. Again, based on all of these errors, pseudo-forensic evidence, diagrams and measurements that calculated by a machine that may not have been working properly, and a jury that was ill-informed on the law. I mean, the injustice in this case is stifling, and we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Metcalf's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kupal. Mr. Damerville.
Justice and Associate Justices, first of all, I want to take the my bad approach and say that, first of all, I'm a former public defender, and it was my suggestion that particular instruction on experts is unfair, mostly to indigent defendants who cannot afford the name expert in large measure. I also want to say briefly, thank you for oral argument. When I was in law school, my evidence professor would stand up in front of his classes every year, and he would say, evidence is not a required class at this law school, true. He said, but appellate advocacy is. Appellate advocacy teaches you how to argue cases before your state Supreme Court. Of course, you will practice for 40 years before you get a chance to give oral argument in a discretionary appeal. But what the heck? When you do, you'll be ready. Well, he was wrong, because it's only taken 30 years and 322 days. Having said that, I just wonder if petitioner has really read this file. The opening argument by yours truly lasted 4 minutes. 4 minutes. This was a case where the evidence of guilt was overwhelming and came out of the mouth of the defendant in the 911 tape that she says is exculpatory. Really? If you look at the trial transcript in this case, what the state did is we took that trial, that 911 tape, and it made the case for us. If you look at it and just listen and hear the defendant saying, oh, I'm having having dry heaves, oh my God, oh this, oh that. If you separate it out from what he said, and just put in what he said, the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. He blasted past me, so I said, fuck it. And I shot him as he ran down the driveway. I mean, that's the evidence in the case. That's the evidence in the case. The defense attorney had an overwhelming and difficult burden in this case. I'd also like to point out, because it's been brought up, is in her reply, replied on the state's response, she says, the failure to complete the Rule 702 Foundation and have Dr. Manoukian designated as an expert in a particular field produced the precise harm that the parties in the court intended to avoid by sanitizing the trial of any reference to expert. This is why the purported trend in the Third Circuit to avoid or use the term expert must be stopped. She says HR Rule 702 requires the proponent of the expert testimony to proffer the witness for qualifications as an expert. There's no language in 702 that requires a proffer. 702 is almost identical to the federal rule. There's no requirement to make a proffer. And then she goes on to say, the trial court's failure to formally accept Dr. Manoukian as an expert in the field of forensic pathology while in the presence of the jury thwarted the jury's ability to properly assess the expert's testimony. The trend around the country is to get rid of the term expert. And the reason it is because we are being inundated with the wars of the experts. And the jury hears the word expert and goes the wrong way. Now, McCormick on Evidence, 6th edition, section 13, page 69, footnote 14. Some experienced litigators recommend that after listing the witness's qualifications, the proponent formally moved that the judge accept the witness as an expert in a particular field. These attorneys believe that the judge's ruling increases the witness's credibility in the juror's eyes. Precisely for that reason, though, some courts hold that it is improper for the judge to make a ruling absent an objection. This change, proposed by me, and accepted by many.
When you say proposed by you, are you talking about this case or in general? Very careful. Does the record in this case suggest how it is that this approach or why it is that this approach was taken?
No, not just this case. Other cases. The case that I completed the evidentiary portion of yesterday, we had a doctor, expert, not by us, but by the defense, and the defense was happy with the instruction as proposed. Okay? There's just no rhyme or reason why we should be misleading juries about experts. I hear the word expert, and you are probably inundated with trial records, especially among well-heeled litigants, with battles of experts. And the battle of experts typically can't happen in a criminal case, because neither the state, and to a greater extent, the defendant, doesn't have the resources to go out and, quote, buy named experts. So what does it deliver to a jury that a guy is an expert as opposed to, okay, he's qualified to give an opinion? And people understand opinions. Now, she's talking about these Dr. Manoukian, who, by the way, there is trial strategy involved in deciding whether or not you even want to object to a person's qualifications. In this particular case, the defense counsel took the opportunity that he had. And when I say that, if you look at the closing arguments, he attacked Dr. Manoukian on the way he was dressed. Dr. Manoukian has a reputation of dressing informally, but when he appeared for that trial, his demeanor, his clothing was shocking. Now, nobody knew that exactly a year and a day later he would be dead from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is always fatal. No one knew that, but certainly his slovenliness created a difficult situation for the state because he was allowed to attack it as part of trial strategy. Rule of thumb evidence. If you get up on, you don't have to go to firearms expert documents about this particular rule of thumb. Shotguns have been in this country for centuries. You can get up on Google and you can put in shotgun spread rule of thumb and you will come out with the whole community of people who use firearms in this country who know that rule of thumb. It's a little bit like what is the normal body temperature of a healthy human body?
Mr. Domerville, that may be true, but I'll tell you, I've never shot a shotgun, so I wouldn't know to do that. I wouldn't know that that would be relevant in this murder case. And if, you know, I would suspect at least some jurors might not know that.
Well,
but I wanted to ask you, you said it was a trend. I don't have anything here in the record which indicates it's a trend. But I have no problem with the fact that some people might not want to use the word expert. But the instruction talks about a person qualified to give opinion testimony. Now, how is the jury supposed to know which person was qualified to give opinion testimony and in what particular field?
Well, first of all, they did not raise the objection to the standard instruction. The petitioner wants us to go back to the standard instruction. The standard instruction doesn't do that either. If there's 25 experts who testify in a trial, the standard instruction, you get it once. You don't get it 25 times. There are people who've been qualified as experts to give opinions, one or more, and you can treat them all the same way.
I'm not sure my question was clear. This instruction was given to the jury,
right?
And so I'm saying when the jury goes back, how is it supposed to evaluate testimony of witnesses if it's not in some way indicated to them that aside from lay witnesses, there is a witness qualified to give opinion testimony? And if so, in what particular field? How is the jury to know that?
How is the jury to know that is they just sat through the qualification testimony of these particular witnesses, which were extremely lengthy, which is why the petitioner has not raised anything about their qualifications to be a forensic pathologist.
Okay.
They were
and
long.
And in what particular field?
How
in the
field of pathology, forensic pathology. And that includes observation of things on bodies, whether there's wadding there, that kind of stuff. He had education and training in ballistics as well. Now he said, "Well, I'm not an expert." Well, you know what?
Well, counsel, you know, basically to understand his opinion on spray pattern and distance analysis for the shotgun, he relied on a textbook.
No,
you know,
I guess you rely on a textbook when you say the average temperature of a healthy human body is 98.6, but you know what? It's an average. It's an estimate. We learn it in school. It's not definitive. There are healthy people. As a matter of fact, today they're saying the actual average is closer to 98.2. If you take your temperature 9 times during the day, you won't get 98.6 a single time. It's an average. And that's what the jury was told, it was an average. In the shot pattern testing that was done is routine shot pattern testing.
Counsel, you know, he says at one point he wasn't an expert in ballistics.
Right.
There's no indication that he goes out and shoots guns, especially shotguns. Okay, so when he gives an opinion regarding distance from a shotgun, you know, if you're looking at him, his reliance on the textbook, which he testifies about, do we take judicial notice that therefore that practice is reasonably relied upon by forensic pathologists to give opinions in that area?
His opinion was qualified. First of all, his opinion was qualified as a rule of thumb. It's an estimate only. That's based on his training and experience. And then we put on
the training and experience as given in his qualification testimony.
Right.
So did he testify that he had 300 or several hundred out of 3,000 autopsies involving firearms, of which a certain number were shotguns, in which I had to determine distance?
Well, his testimony would take up the rest of my time because it's pretty lengthy about his qualifications. Okay. So what I'm saying is this. After he testifies, we put on you call him a detective. He's got training in the National Rifle Association. He had training with SRT, Strategic Response Teams, SWAT teams. He's a certified qualifier for all of the firearms training.
He's a firearms instructor.
He's a firearms instructor.
Okay, so
and what he did was he went out and he took measurements and he shot at targets. Classic shot pattern target testing, which you don't have to be any kind of a super guy to do. If you can shoot straight and measure straight, you can shoot at a pattern.
And who told that to the jury?
Who told that to the jury?
Right.
Well, we didn't have to tell that to the jury because the defense was not arguing that pattern testing was wrong.
Even you disagreed with Officer Amo, didn't you?
Oh, of course. Of course. He got up there and gave some witnesses are just very cooperative.
So
and
you,
nice.
in your response, I guess, to the application, you said Officer Amo gave a wrong answer to the question from the defendant's attorney.
That's right.
And I guess you said something like, everybody knows that, you know, if you're close, when you shoot someone at a close range, it'll make a round hole, no matter whether a person's jumping up or down.
That's true.
Or whatever.
That's
so
true.
So in effect, you impeached yourself, his own qualifications as an expert.
No. You got the wrong part.
Oh, okay. You tell me that.
Oh, yeah, I will, if I got time. Okay, here it is. Mythbusters. You see it on TV all the time. There's a lot of people out there that think that if you take a firearm, a shotgun, and you jerk it, that you're going to spread the width of the pattern. The pattern will change. Okay, you jerk it, and it's going to spread the pattern. That is totally a myth. And my choices were at that time, tactical-wise, because we did this trial in 6 days. Tactical-wise, what do I do? Do I just leave that benefit to the defendant, or do I bring this guy back in and bring in some other people to impeach my other witness? And I said, no, I'll just send him to Mythbusters after the trial's over, because that is a myth. The human body cannot jerk a shotgun fast enough to change the spread. The spread will remain round, doesn't it? He may hit a different place, but the spread itself will be round. There's no question about it.
So you believe he wasn't really qualified to give that kind of an opinion?
He was qualified to do what he testified to, which is he went to a shooting range. He took the same shotgun.
But he was posed that question, and he answered that question before the jury.
By the defense. By the defense. To the benefit of the defendant.
So, Counselor, are you saying that any person out here could go to a firing range and do that test, and that would be admissible expert opinion?
I think what I said was any person who could shoot straight could do that test. Shotgun pattern testing has been around for longer than me, and I'm getting up there.
But for that conclusion to be made, and you know, you mentioned Google, is there any indication that that Amul made references to other sources, authoritative or otherwise, to conclude that that was how that test was done, that was an appropriate test to determine spread patterns of the shotgun?
These two defense attorneys were both from gun country, Texas and North Carolina. Those tests and those things about guns, they had plenty of expertise. They were not ineffective with respect to guns and firearms. The jury was vetted about shotguns, and that gets to another thing, because you didn't get the jury questioning the jurors in this case. And it goes to some of the other issues you raised. You didn't have time to speak to them. But that jury was heavily vetted about marijuana, medical marijuana, and about shotguns. Okay. Marijuana is very popular in Hawaii County. We had 35,000 voters that voted to make it the lowest law enforcement priority. The state used two peremptories out of 12. The state didn't care about medical marijuana. The state cared about somebody get shot in the back. That's what the state cared about. The other issue she raised about the grand jury transcripts, I just want to touch on briefly. She says that
let me ask you, is the book that Dr. Manoukian referred to, is that a source that is normally and customarily relied on by experts in the field?
You know, when you question an expert, if you want to try to tear them up, you can ask them what they read, and you can spend 6 weeks doing a trial. But if you have the opinion that that expert is just unshakable, and credentials are too good, you're not going to waste your time and the court's time doing that.
So there's nothing.
So sorry.
No, go ahead.
He actually testified that there were, he didn't say one textbook, he said textbooks, as if it was an exception.
We did this trial in 6 days. And I was the 911 operator on this case. By 911 operator on this case, I didn't record the tape. What I did is I got the case 10 days before trial. Okay. And the overwhelming, devastating testimony in this case included a tape of this defendant. He was installing the surveillance system, and while he's installing the surveillance system, he's making statements about what he's going to do. He left a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house to move into a ohana so he could overlook his greenhouse, and he was armed with his shotgun, and he had a box of shells next to his dirty socks, and he was sitting in there waiting. He was sitting in there waiting. That was the evidence, and the defense and the prosecutors did not know that until I got the case and I went looking for stuff, because his surveillance system, according to the system, it stopped recording on April 30th. And this event happened on May the 6th. So I didn't have time with 10 days before trial to look at 30-some days worth of marijuana plants growing. So I signed an investigator to do it, because somebody's got to look. And we found, while he's setting up the system, he's saying those things that are in the record.
Mr. Dimerville, who proposes a change in this approach to experts?
Well, I think I proposed it. I think Judge Harrell looked at it. And he
Is this stemmed from any national movement?
Yes, it does, and it's all cited in my response and in my appellate brief. The federal courts are going that way. They're saying, look, it's unfair. We're raising the cost of litigation to have battles of experts because the bar thinks that...
That's only to remove the use of the term expert.
That's right.
Right. But not with respect to the procedures in terms of qualifying experts.
Well, if you look at the procedures around the country and the in McCormick on evidence, it says on objection... The witness's proponent must show that the witness has sufficient skill and knowledge upon objection. And that's the way it's been. It's on objection. You go around the country, it's on objection. You know, if nobody's objecting, and it appears that the qualifications are there, when that judge allows that opinion, he has implicitly acknowledged that guy's qualified. That's how it works.
You know... Did you cite Judge Ritchie in terms of this proposal to change the approach to expert testimony?
Right.
Okay.
Yes, I did.
And it originated with him, right?
Well, he was on a long time before I was. I'm too busy.
Okay, and so his primary thing was don't use the word expert because that has all kinds of connotations for the jury.
That's right.
Okay. But he doesn't say you should change the procedures in terms of trying to determine whether a witness is qualified as an expert.
Well, the procedure that she wants is that procedure to be done in the presence of the jury. And that's like swallowing the change. You either do it outside the presence of the jury, or you could ask for a cursory, do you have an objection over there, counselor, to wake him up if he's that bad? But the, in my view, it should be changed. We should follow Ritchie. It's going to help our indigent defendants.
But Ritchie says, you go do a motion in limine or you have a pretrial hearing to determine the basis for this conclusions, the qualifications, and whether or not there would be any prejudice arising out of the testimony.
And that's fine. Do it outside.
And none of that was done here, was it?
No, it wasn't done here because an objection would have been useless.
Are you familiar with a case called Barbie versus Queens Medical Center?
I think... I got
you have a few more minutes. That's a civil case where the ICA looked at the question of whether the approach we've talked about here today was error or not and indicated... that we do not suggest the circuit court was required to take the approach it took, but rather that it was not an abuse of discretion for it to do so. So were you familiar, is that a case that was considered or argued before the court here at all?
Frankly, I'm so busy. The only civil cases that I would read would be my own. But it just makes sense, especially we can bring down the cost of justice if we implement that rule, because a lot of times thinking in their mind is it worth the word expert? You know, is that going to help me get one place farther? And with your wealthy litigants, the answer is yes. They can go out and buy 26 and go out, well, Swarthmore expert's not good enough, Harvard is better. Well, shoot, my daughter went to both, so maybe she ought to be an expert and go out and make more. Support me in my old age. Thank you. Any other questions while I have time left? Because there are some other things about strategy here that are important. Oh, the grand jury transcript. She says that she cannot supplement the record with the grand jury transcripts and the trial and the preliminary hearing transcripts. And that's just plain wrong. If you look at Rule 10 of the Hawaii Appellate Rules, as it says now, it refers to as in the Hawaii Court Record Rules, and you read the Hawaii Court Record Rules, if there's a transcript, if it's been created, You can consider it. If she raises ineffective assistance of counsel, all she has to do is ask to supplement the record with the transcripts. That's all. She wants to send it back down for the trial court to take judicial notice of something that you can take judicial notice of here. This court has taken judicial notice many times on appeal, and the reason that they want to take that approach is there's nothing wrong with those transcripts. Absolutely nothing. The state is proud of those transcripts, and I didn't do them. They are very fair transcripts, including the problem with the grand jury is they were conflicted, whether or not this is murder or whether or not this is manslaughter. And if you have enough of them there, they talked about, well, can I indict for, can we charge him with manslaughter? Yes, you can. Well, what about murder? Well, yes, you can. Well, if we don't know what to do, does that mean he walks free? Or can the prosecutor come back another time? And the answer that the grand jury counsel gave was, he can come back another time. Justice, I became a prosecutor because I have been a public defender. And I am sensitive, and I hope the people that I left behind when I retire next month are sensitive to making the system fair. And one of the ways you make it fair is you make it quicker. You get judges down there that try cases and take all this other stuff when they're in trial. Get another per diem judge to do it. But don't take a trial that takes 4 days to do and turn it into a 3-week trial simply because that judge is trying to do too much. That makes trials more expensive. That makes judges tired. That makes attorneys tired. And it's just not the way to run a railroad. And we can do better. Trials are important, not just for me. Trials are important for young attorneys. They're important. And we got to give them more of them. And that's my soapbox. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Damerville. Ms. Kupow, your rebuttal.
Well, it's only fair that I get to get on my soapbox. And I'm not an expert. Prosecutor brought up Googling that anybody can Google shotguns. And like Justice Acoba, I've never shot a shotgun. But, I asked around, I did a little bit of research, and what's troubling is what the experts testify to, it appears it's not true. If, again, I'm not an expert, but birdshot number 6, you asked an experienced hunter, could it kill somebody from 60 feet? They'd laugh. They'd laugh. On this record, again, this conviction was obtained on faulty forensics, where these people were not qualified as experts. And in looking at the 911 call, and the
I'm
fact
sorry,
that birdshot.
You're saying that a shotgun shot at 60 feet cannot kill somebody?
That's the general consensus, yes,
any evidence as to that in the record?
Well, there is evidence from Officer Smith that he had been shot at that time, yes.
Isn't that where defense counsel went with Officer Amo to say, this stuff wouldn't even go through cardboard silhouettes?
Yes.
So and that theory was that aired in this trial.
It was aired, but this brings me to my next point. I would ask the court to look at the prosecutor's rebuttal closing, where this prosecutor may have been the one to have thought of starting this trend of keeping out the term expert, not putting these witnesses on a pedestal above other witnesses. But this very prosecutor used in his rebuttal that very term, expert, by comparing Dr. Manoukian, singling out Dr. Manoukian, and analogizing him to Gandhi. Yes, his clothing, it was brought up that he wasn't wearing appropriate clothing, and that's maybe defense counsel attacked his credibility, his expertise, based on the mere appearance of this witness. But again, in rebuttal, the prosecutor stated, if Mahatma Gandhi came in here to testify about what he was an expert in, if he came in here and testified in a loincloth,
but gave you his credentials, his experience, his training, would you dismiss it because he came in a loincloth? Look at the facts of this case. Now, the trend may be very well intentioned. He was a public defender, sure. You know, as a public defender, sometimes I don't want to use the word expert. But on the facts of this case, Dr. Manoukian's testimony was held up on a pedestal. He was told by the prosecutor, told the jury to believe his testimony above all others. And that's how this conviction came about. Again,
counsel, this is her time to rebut. So this, I'm sorry, you need to take the seat. Thank you.
Again, the injustice is stifling, and we're asking this court to reverse this erroneous conviction. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Appreciate both of your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.